Namaste, Jai Hind. You're watching or listening to another edition of the ANI podcast with Smita Prakash. My guest today is the American diplomat Richard Rahul Verma. Rich Verma, as he's popularly known, has served as the US ambassador to India from 2014 to 2017, and currently he serves as the Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources. He's the first person of Indian descent to hold the position of American ambassador to India. Rich Verma also served as the Chief Legal Officer and Head of Global Public Policy at MasterCard from 2020 to 2023. Rich Verma is currently on a visit to India, Sri Lanka and Maldives to strengthen cooperation between the US and each of the three countries in the Indo-Pacific region. Thank you, Ambassador Verma, for being part of the podcast.
Thank you.
Very glad to have you here on the sidelines of the Raisina dialogue.
Great to be here. Great to be back in India.
In New Delhi, right?
In New Delhi.
Yeah. Good to see you back. And so you go into election mode. Your country goes into election mode. India goes into election mode. What is the bandwidth in DC now for bilateral relationship to take it forward? Does everything go into a holding pattern in an election year?
Oh, definitely not. First of all, thank you. Thank you for having me here. And I would just say we are actually redoubling our efforts on the U.S.-India relationship. And you see that in the number of activities and just the way the president talks about the relationship. Of course, the state visit last year. And you know, I'm here because I wanted to let people know I've really never seen the relationship as strong and robust, as diverse as it is today. I just look at the number of bilateral dialogues we have coming up, the number of really interesting initiatives coming up from in the defense area, from emerging technologies to clean energy, health, so much more. And we can talk about this. We've broken every record that we keep in terms of trade and defense and people-to-people ties, visas issued. That will continue, election year or not an election year. We don't have the luxury of kind of not engaging with the rest of the world. I think the world expects our leadership, and I think this relationship is too important. I'd also say this relationship has seen gains. Really, I use the year 2000 as the starting point when President Clinton came. Because before that, we had a up and down history, as I think most people know. But if I look at the last 24 years, you know, start of this century, with that visit, we've had sustained gains in every category. And we've had it through Republican and Democratic administrations. We've had it through two parties here. And so elections are super important. But I think the relationship has a certain durability to it, and that will continue. And so we're excited about the direction of the relationship, regardless of what might be happening in either country.
I'm going to come to what all we are doing now, India and the U.S. But first, I want to pick on the point that you spoke about, which is you pick 2000, the year 2000, and you say that that's where the upward trajectory started and during, you know, President Clinton's era. I want to come to the point where you came in 2014. That was the real rock bottom low. The Devyani Khobargade case had happened.
I was hoping it wasn't because I came here. Right.
Yeah. You came in during that period where where things looked it was almost like back to the 70s during the Cold War era when things had gone bad. And if you remember, there were those that area near the embassy, the boulders had been put in, and it was in a very bad position. And you came in then. What was the brief that President Obama had given you when you were sent in here?
Well, he really cares about this relationship. Cared about the relationship. President Biden cared about the relationship, but I guess I would, I remember the period very well, obviously. But even though we had this incident with the Indian diplomat, there was still a lot going on in the relationship. We still had all the defense exercises. We still had all the companies doing trade. Yes, we had a dispute and a disagreement. I think one of the takeaways from that experience was the ability to continue on while you have disagreements, and that's what mature relationships are all about. the brief from President Obama was to go out and continue to build and deepen this relationship. He was a huge believer in it. But I can go back to when I was a Senate staffer in the Senate leadership office, and there was a chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee named Joe Biden from Delaware, who in the year 2002 said, if the U.S. and India are the closest friends and partners in the year 2020, the world will be a safer and more prosperous place. Joe Biden had that vision over 20 years ago. And again, I've worked on this relationship for a long time, and that was when a Republican administration, the Bush administration, came in and briefed us on U.S.-India civil nuclear deal. We went into a rare classified session of the U.S. Senate, which I will never forget, and the person leading the debate on the Democratic side was then-Senator Biden to say why India should have this carve-out in the international nuclear framework to allow the civil nuclear deal to go forward. So we've, one, I've worked on the relationship for a while, but two, whether it was President Obama during his term or whether it was Senator Biden or whether it was President Clinton or President Bush, we've seen this kind of commitment to the relationship because we know how important these large democratic powers are coming together to do good things for the broader international community. What does that mean? Upholding peaceful rule of law, peaceful resolution of disputes, the rules-based order that we've come to live by and so many people have benefited by. U.S. and India can do a lot to preserve and protect that.
Two points I want to talk about. One is that, you know, whenever we talk about India-U.S. relations, everybody sees the watershed moment is when President Bush invested so much of capital on the civilian nuclear deal. But you bring in the fact that there was backroom activity happening with the caucus, with the Democrat caucus, and with President, well, then Senator Biden, who was also working and briefed, I believe, President Bush on this issue. So that was interesting, what you said. The second point is about, you know, the shared values that you talk about. One has often seen that whenever there's a state visit, when President Biden came in last year or when Prime Minister Modi went, there's always this talk about shared values. But it seems like that term is used by diplomats. But the think tanks, the media, when they report on these visits or on interactions, it's more about shared interests, transactional relationship. So where does this truth really lie?
Oh, this is an easy one for me. I don't think there's any question. And anyone who asserts that we don't have shared values, I think, doesn't actually appreciate the history. And not the history going back 20 years. I mean the history going back decades and decades. You know, our great writers and philosophers over 150 years have been sharing the ideas about post-colonial independence, about the struggle for justice, about civil rights, about equality, about democracy. And that is the foundation. There's a reason why there's nearly 5 million Americans of Indian and South Asian descent in the United States. We are drawn together in so many ways. We are not just a transactional buyer-seller relationship. This is not just about interests. Of course, every country has interests, and those countries pursue those interests. We are uniquely situated. I think of my own father, who came to the United States in 1963 after living through a very tumultuous time here in India, very active in the Indian independence movement, and became a writer of South Asian literature. And he would correspond with famous writers here, Malk Raj Anand, others, about post-colonial issues, about independence, about justice. I think of what Mahatma Gandhi wrote to President Roosevelt in the early 1900s, which was, thank you for giving me the writings of Henry David Thoreau. I think about Gandhi being influenced, I think about Martin Luther King being influenced by Gandhi. I could give you dozens and dozens of examples where our values form the bedrock and the foundation of this relationship. And it's evident today. And that's what makes this relationship special and different. And ultimately, that's what we have to stay true to. All of the other activities on top of it are important, but we can never lose sight of that foundation. That is the glue that holds us together.
But what happens when policymakers in D.C. keep reading about illiberal, so-called illiberal government being in power in New Delhi, with not being in on the same page as a liberal democracy with and liberal values that United States has? So don't policymakers get influenced when those articles come out?
Sure. I mean, look, we have big, noisy democracies in both capitals. I've certainly lived here and seen plenty of critiques about the United States. I've seen critiques in the United States about India. And look, I think that's what having a free press is about. And I also think when we have differences, we sit down and we address them. It is in our collective interest to support civil society. It is in our collective interest to support a free press. It is in our collective interest to support democratic aspirations of minority communities and to be more inclusive. That's what our leaders talk about when they get together. That model helps, frankly, push back against the authoritarian and autocratic vision of the world, which does exist and is the counter narrative. And we have to stand up against that. That's why I'm so vested in this relationship and so, frankly, encouraged by what we can do together.
You've witnessed that relationship in various stages,
right?
When you were in D.C., when you were here. In fact, when you were here, there was a change of guard in New Delhi. Chief Minister Modi becomes Prime Minister Modi, a man who had been rejected a visa by the U.S., suddenly becomes Prime Minister now. How did you maneuver the relationship?
I didn't have to do any maneuvering. I mean, I think, look, I so appreciate that President Obama and Prime Minister Modi, right out of the gate, I think September of 2014, got together and, you know, it was their collective handshake about trying to move this relationship forward. They saw the huge advantages.
They met, I think, 9 times during your tenure, if I'm not mistaken.
At least, if not a dozen. And we had 3 summits. The Prime Minister addressed the Congress. President Obama was here for Republic Day. I mean, and each of those visits was so transformative because it actually generated a set of work and initiatives that would never have been possible. I give you one important example, the Paris Climate Agreement, right? We were stuck. This was a big international agreement that no one thought was possible. You know what made it possible is a U.S. head of state and an Indian head of state sitting down with each other, understanding each other's position. And for the first time, we saw, we saw what is possible on the international framework of how to actually change the outcome on issues that matter. Climate change matters. Now we, of course, have pandemic and global health issues to deal with, and I think that's an important area of work. We have cybersecurity and cyber defense. That's an important area of work. So we saw what's possible, and so I didn't have to maneuver anything. I just had to, frankly, follow in the wake of all the activity between these two heads of state who knew the value in the relationship.
You, as ambassador, I think you were the first ambassador to have toured all 28 states.
Yes.
What was your takeaway after those? You know, I have to get to the present, but I just can't resist asking about this. What happened in those? What was your takeaway?
Yeah. So, look, I got some great advice from Ambassador Sandhu, who the Indian ambassador to the United States, and then the deputy chief of mission at the time. He said, do me a favor, make sure you spend some time, not just in New Delhi, but going around the country. And I wanted to do that anyway. I didn't set out to try to go to every state in India, but we were traveling so much. By 15 months into it, I think we had been to 16 or 17, 18 states. And the team said, look, you should really get to all of them. What I found was this incredibly vibrant, exciting diversity within the country. diversity of thought, diversity of background, experience, innovative, just very liberating and inspiring to get out of the capital city. Secondly, I saw Americans all over doing incredible work. I saw college students, I saw retirees, I saw people who were coming to share. I remember going to various projects that were having a real impact, whether it was solar-powered lighting for cricket bat makers who had to do this job on the side of highways and they didn't have electricity or lights, or whether it was people working on ending tuberculosis in parts of the country. And so I had a different appreciation for the contribution that our country was making at the citizen-to-citizen level. And I also was able to get out and tell our story, you know, public diplomacy. It really matters. So what was the U.S. doing? Why was the relationship important? And frankly, I got to go back to some of those places that my own family was from. I saw where my mom...
Jalandhar.
Yes, but I saw where my mother and grandmother settled after partition. I saw where my dad went to school. I saw where my mom and grandmother taught. And I will say, to this day, probably one of the most inspiring experiences I had really over the last two or three decades was going back to that school, which is in an impoverished area of Jalandhar, which still exists today. And now 70 and 80-year-old women coming out to tell me that without my grandmother and mother, they would not be there today, that they told them about the importance of education and studying and learning. And that was hugely impactful for me.
You had a very successful tenure as ambassador, but where does India come in the pecking order for the Biden administration? Why was there no ambassador for 2 years here?
You mean after that
period?
Look, I think this gets...
There was in between, of course, there was Charge d'Affaires.
Yeah, look, I think this gets into our, you know, Senate confirmation process, change in administrations. We have a clunky process, to say the least, about trying to get people out and into posts. This is something I'm working a lot on in my current role as deputy secretary, trying to make sure our positions, our top positions are filled. But again, I just go back to how much time and how much interest and how much enthusiasm the president, secretary of state, national security advisors, and others have for the relationship. You credited me with success. I appreciate that. I will just say we have an incredible team here, incredible locally employed staff who propel this relationship forward. And I would say Ambassador Garcetti and the team are doing a fabulous job.
The American administration, the American business community, they seem to be very bullish on, or they appear to be, it's quite clear, bullish about endorsing robust ties with India. But the left-leaning civil society is very critical about the American administration wanting to do more business, more security-related business with India. How do you see the two?
Yeah, I guess I don't see it exactly that way from my vantage point. And again, I've seen this, you know, through multiple phases over 20 or 25 years. I see generally a very pro-U.S.-India posture. Yes, it's from a business point of view, but when I go around to universities as well and talk to university presidents and deans and others, they want to deepen the education partnership. When I talk to NGOs in the United States, they want to deepen the relationship with civil society here. So I don't see people saying you shouldn't go do the following. When people have concerns, they certainly raise them. And again, that gets back to two friends ought to be able to come to the table, talk about all those things that are working, and also talk about those things on both sides where there are concerns. And we do that today. And I'm, you know, that is the sign of a very mature and dynamic, frankly, successful relationship.
The read in India is that, you know, it's difficult for Indians to fathom as to why America doesn't crack down on separatists, on Khalistanis who issue threat towards India, towards the Indian Prime Minister, attack the Indian consulates and deface places of worship. For Indians, it is like, why can America not understand this? Why can America not deal with this problem?
Yeah, look, we've, you know, for those who engage in violence or any attacks, they're held completely accountable. And our, I will say, our diplomatic security team has done a very thorough and important job in ensuring not only Indian diplomats, but all those diplomats posted in the United States are safe and secure. And there's no higher priority for us, for the Secretary of State, and we will continue to do that. Look, do we have, when people say things, and we each have different rules when it comes to free speech, we have to assess where is the line crossed into conduct. But we won't tolerate any violence or any kind of harassment directed at officials, and we will crack down on it where the law allows us to do it, and we have done it, and we will continue to do it.
But you've been reading Indian media. I mean, you can. It's quite apparent for everybody to see that Indians find it very difficult to fathom as to why Gurpatwant Singh, a person who's been designated as a terrorist in India, why is he allowed to still function and conduct his activities, which are clearly secessionist, encouraging secessionists in India?
Yeah, I'm not going to get into specific cases, but I just kind of go back to what I said about, you know, we have to operate within the law, and we do. And when people cross that line, they will be held accountable.
So do you think that relationship is robust enough to withstand this current problem which has occurred, which is the allegations that India was involved in an alleged attempt to eliminate an Indian terrorist, but a U.S. National in the U.S.?
Look, we raised the concerns with the Indian government at the most senior levels. They took it seriously. They've launched an investigation, and we look forward to continuing to hear back from the Indian authorities about what they found. But it's a very important issue, and it's being addressed.
In what manner?
Like, well, I understand, there is a committee of inquiry that's looking into this and investigating, and we would expect to hear...
In the U.S.?
No, here in India.
India.
Here in India. And we would expect to hear back as to what has been discovered and who's been held accountable for the activities.
Because, you know, there was this... 2023, there was multi-sectoral work which was done by India and U.S. in collaborations. It was all in an upward trajectory. And then suddenly this thing happens towards the second half of the year. And then relationships slide down by December because of this. Do you see that?
I haven't seen that. Again, I think we have to unpack some of these things. This is a serious issue. It is being addressed, will be addressed. So let that proceed. But again, I'm here seeing all these incredible kind of companies and innovators and progress in the relationship, which is also taking place at the same time. So we've got to be able to handle multiple sets of issues at the same time, some of which may be very difficult.
I'll get into the defense aspect. You know, the transfer of critical defense technology. India has asked the U.S. to remove the stringent hurdles, which includes complicated rules and regulations. Is that progressing?
Oh, it's progressed over 20 years. When I think back to where we were in the early 2000s, we had no defense trade, zero, between the U.S. and India. Now the number is somewhere $24, $25 billion in goods and technology that have been transferred. But now we're in a whole different phase, which is about co-production and co-development, which by definition means technology is being transferred. We've reformed our export control laws very significantly. Now, we still care about where that technology ends up, where the intellectual property ends up, and we have to make sure it's protected and preserved. And that's exactly the kind of assurances that we've gotten back from the Indian system. So I actually see a system that's working. The U.S. and India are major defense partners, a status we don't have with any other country in the world. We are building this incredibly kind of robust defense relationship. When I go and see the defense exercises that our two militaries do together. It's very heartening. It's very inspiring. It's very sophisticated at every level. And that is a good thing, and that should reassure people.
An area of concern also is when India says that the weapon systems and platforms that America gives Pakistan, that can end up with China, and reverse technology can be used. So when you were talking about where does it end up, it could end up with China via Pakistan.
I just think you have to look at the trajectory of where we are on this defense relationship and where we are on the U.S.-Pakistan defense relationship. We have an important relationship with Pakistan, but we in no way or anywhere remotely close to what we're doing with India on the defense partnership. They're not even in the same category.
Mr. Verma, you're going to Maldives and Sri Lanka. What is on the schedule there?
Well,
China,
kind of like here, full set of meetings. No, look, in this job as Deputy Secretary of State for Management, I also spend a lot of time with our teams, making sure they have what they need. But yes, we will do the full set of bilateral meetings and foreign policy meetings. These are important relationships, bilateral relationships, and so we will take stock of where we are. We will try to take each of those relationships to the next level. We will talk about our Indo-Pacific strategy, which is very important, and we will reinforce the things that matter, the rules-based order and standing up for democratic principles. We will look to increase our trade connectivity. We will look to increase our security cooperation where we can. So there's a lot on the agenda, and I'm looking forward to the visits.
In conclusion, I'm just going to read out a quote. Atul Kashyap had said this when he was U.S. Chief of Mission in Sri Lanka and Maldives when you were here.
Yeah.
And I found this quote and I really liked it. It says, "It's a source of pride for Indian Americans that Rich Verma became the first American of Indian descent to serve as United States Ambassador to India. His posting highlighted how so many Indian Americans are ably and loyally serving the United States in expanding and strengthening bilateral relations between the world's two great democracies. Rich, like all Indian Americans in the bureaucracy, is in bipartisan politics and in business, shares our passionate commitment to seeing our 1.6 billion citizens forge an unbeatable partnership to advance the prosperity and security of both our countries and the entire world, create good jobs for our citizens, and strengthen pluralistic democratic values and transparent rules-based order across the Indo-Pacific region."
Wow, that's so nice. I didn't even know he said that.
So he said this about you, and I asked him on the podcast too. and because both of you have kind of similar experiences as expat Indians. So I just wanted a concluding remark from you about this.
Look, I've been very blessed in my career. Again, when I think about what made this possible, though, it is the hard work and sacrifice of so many other people. And again, I go back to my mother and father, which took such big risks, and they worked so hard for us. But I would say, you know, the fact that my mother, this incredible person, product of partition, school teacher, my father also educator, fought for Indian independence, could show up in the United States with almost next to nothing. My dad tells a great immigrant story of showing up in 1963 with $14 and a bus ticket. The fact that his son could come back to India as the U.S. ambassador, could rise to be the Deputy Secretary of State, that is a long shot of long shots. That is a lightning strike. It is also a very American story. In many ways, it is a very Indian story. It's about rising up through the ranks. I now feel a very special obligation to make sure that same opportunity exists for other people, for all the other people who are coming up behind me. That means speaking up for people who may not have a voice, speaking up for people who may feel like they're on the outer edges a little bit. And so we have an obligation now to make sure others can be able to have that pathway that I've been afforded. And I'm just so grateful for everything that they did, for all those people that supported our family and have supported me. And I'm grateful that I've been able to work on this relationship and see it prosper in the way that it has.
Wishing you all the best, Ambassador Verma. Thank you so much for coming to our podcast.
Thank you so much. I appreciate
it. Thanks. Thank you for watching or listening to this edition of the ANI podcast with Smita Prakash. Do like or subscribe on whichever channel you have seen this or heard this. Namaste. Jai Hind.